course, no disparagement of the importance of those rights to individual liberty. I mean simply not to talk about them here because of the pressure of time. I mean to talk rather simply about those basic liberties which are to be found in the First Amendment to the Constitution, the first article of the Bill of Rights. And those are simply freedom of conscience, freedom of expression, freedom of assembly or association. We don't, I think, we're happy and fortunate that we don't have to spend much time talking about freedom of conscience, because I think it's fair to say that that freedom is accorded high respect and general recognition in the United States. I don't mean to say that there aren't problems in regard to it. I don't mean to say that there aren't blemishes in the observance of the Constitution's guarantee regarding an establishment of religion and the free exercise thereof. But I do mean to say simply that by and large throughout the United States there is, I think, a high degree of acceptance that that religious intolerance is a menace to all of us, a menace to the nation as an entity, as well as to individuals within the nation, and that the best way for us to live together is through a mutual tolerance and respect for one another's individual modes of worship, one another's individual concepts of the divinity. Let me talk a little bit more about the freedom of the press and the freedom of speech guaranteed in the First Amendment. American newspapers occupy an extraordinary, indeed, I think it's fair to say, a unique position in the American political system. They are private enterprises operated for private profit, and yet they enjoy an almost complete immunity from regulation by the government. Why does this particular institution, made up, as I say, of private business undertakings, why does this particular institution have, under the Constitution, a grant of immunity from governmental control? Well, in simple terms, it is, I think, because the men who wrote the Constitution conceived of a free press as one of the elements in a complex system of checks and balances which they devised to keep governmental authority within appropriate bounds. They desired a press which, so far from being subject to censorship by the government, would serve as a censor of the government. And indeed, it was in precisely those terms that Thomas Jefferson and a number of others at that time spoke of the role of the press. No government ought to be without censors, Jefferson once said. And while the press is free, none will. Well, in our system then, the press has an obligation not only to give a self-governing people the information about their time, about their situation and their problems, which they must have if government is to be genuinely by the consent of the government, by the consent of the governed. But the press has an obligation also to serve as a kind of sentinel of freedom. A part of its business indeed I think the most vital part of its business, is to serve as a censor of the government, to stand on guard, to warn the American people when that government encroaches in any way upon the rights and the liberties of individual Americans. And there was an instance which occurred just a few days ago in which it seems to me that the press played this role and played it rather effectively. You've read, I'm sure, about the saga of William Heckler, a man in San Francisco who was picked up on the streets of the city about 5 o'clock in the afternoon as he came from his job, picked up by the authorities of the Immigration Service, whisked onto an airplane without being given an opportunity to go home, to set his affairs in order, to pick up his belongings, or even to say goodbye to his wife. Whisked onto a plane, flown out to Vancouver, Canada, and then flown summarily across the ocean to Finland, the country where he was born, but which he had not seen for 50-odd years, a country which he had not seen and which was as unfamiliar to him as to most of you, which he had not seen since he was 2.5 months old. Well, there was a general outcry in the press against this arbitrary exercise of governmental authority. And this is one of those instances. I do not suggest to you by any means that the press has been uniformly faithful in its discharge of this censorial obligation. And I should not be altogether astonished if in later discussion some of you should assail me with charges about the failure of the press to fulfill its obligations as censor in every respect. And I'm going to have to plead guilty in a good many instances. But this at least was, I think, an illustration of how newspapers can serve the interests of society, can serve as a censor of the government and as a champion of individual liberty by bringing to attention, as a sentinel should, an encroachment upon the rights of a citizen, an extension of governmental authority beyond its proper limits. Now, this is a mechanism which no totalitarian society possesses. In a dictatorship, this kind of arbitrary seizure of an individual, this kind of ruthless deportation of a man without giving him so much as a chance to turn around or know where he was going. This could happen without anybody hearing about it at all. Here in the United States, a free press serves at least as it ought to serve always, to give the community warning of a violation of its rights. And this is, I think, an immensely constructive and useful service which contributes to the security of the nation by forcing its government to remain within the area which government is supposed to stay within. Freedom of speech works, I think, in the same utilitarian way. You know, the men who wrote the Bill of Rights were not sentimentalists. They were men who were exceedingly practical. They were men who planned to establish an enduring government which would be able that function through great changes, through international and national crises. They designed a government to endure for many, many generations. And they were not sentimental in what they were doing. When they provided that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, they did it not merely because they thought that free speech would be a pleasure for the individuals enjoying it. They did it because they understood that the nation itself would be strengthened and solidified and made more enduring if its individual members were free to discuss its problems, were free to criticize its government, were free to set forth ideas of all sorts, some of which might be distasteful or even abhorrent to the majority. Nothing could be more mistaken, I think, than the supposition that you get national unity out of uniformity of opinion, out of uniformity of habit among citizens. National unity comes in a quite different way. It grows not out of uniformity, but out of the resolution of conflict through discussion. It grows out of a common consideration of problems in which minority views have a chance to be heard, have a chance, if they can, to win their way, so that when majority rule prevails, those of the minority have at least a sense that they had their chance to be heard, had their chance to win their way, and so through a recognition of that chance, they are able to accept the decision of a majority. Silence, you know, may mask dissent and disunity. It may give the appearance of consent or of unity, but it is, when it is imposed and enforced, a terribly dangerous thing to the security of the state. Because when opinion is expressed, when it is confined, it becomes, like anything confined, explosive. And because it has no orderly outlet, it may find its expression in ways that are very dangerous to the community.